So last week, we lit the candle that was, look at that, we got it. Sometimes you just gotta, we gotta bend, we gotta play. So the Advent candle of hope, and this week I want to talk a little bit about joy. And so we'll light a candle. You can do it. I believe in you. And just want to read a little bit about the idea of Advent, but in joy. And so just something written for us this morning within that. Advent is the time of getting ready. It's preparation. Getting ready time is not mainly about busy activity, entertainment, and fatigue. Getting ready time is hopeful imagination, pondering, asking, thinking, and redeciding, what is this? That is all of this really all about? In this season, we receive and walk in the spirit of joy. And in this week, joy. Which means we receive a spirit of openness, generosity, and energy. That an electric presence may come over us, carrying us to do compassionate things we have not yet done. Kingdom of God things we did not think we had in us. Neighborly love from which we may have previously cringed. The whole tenor of Advent is that God may act in us, through us, and beyond us more than we imagined. Because the joy of newness is on its way to dwell among us. So joy in this second week of Advent. I'd love to pray, and then we're going to jump into the birth narrative. Would you pray with me? Gracious God, we bless you for this morning. We bless you for the opportunity to gather here now. And as we open the scriptures, and as we look at the story, the birth of you, Jesus, God among us, with us, God, we just open ourselves to you. May our minds be open. May our hearts be open to you. And God, as the psalmist says, my prayer also is, may the posture, the meditation of my heart, and may the words of my mouth bring honor and glory to you and you alone, my Lord, my rock, and my Savior. And may we have ears to hear and hearts to understand what you have for each one of us this morning. In the name of Christ, we pray. Amen. Amen. As we come to the birth narrative. Now, just so we know that the birth narrative, we actually find the birth of Jesus in two places in the scriptures, at least when it speaks of like a baby type of thing. John has his own birth narrative, the Gospel of John, which is a different kind of birth narrative. But one, we have the Gospel book of Matthew and the Gospel book of Luke. That talk a bit about it and which kind of shape the traditional setting that we have. And if we were to do a little trivia this morning and I were to ask you how many wise men show up at Jesus' birth, you would tell me what? Three, and the Bible tells us, yeah, doesn't give us a number. So, and actually, if you study the whole idea of magi or even that, it's, and I tried to like really tackle that one, it's interesting, but they say probably at minimum there was 12. So the fact that we get three, we just literally, I mean, we're learning from our nativity scenes that were apparently pulled out of, I don't know, Pageantville that we did, which is interesting. And what, if I were to say, what animals were at Jesus' birth? You might say cows, donkey, yeah, sheep. Yeah, and the Bible tells us, yeah, none of that. And if I were to ask you, what did the innkeeper say to Mary and Joseph when they got there? You would say, there's no room, but the problem is there's no innkeeper mentioned in the Bible. There's no innkeeper that's even mentioned in the Bible. Now, it does, as in the narrative says, there was no room for them, but it's not because an innkeeper said that. There's no dialogue there, but we've worked that one into the pageant. Yet we didn't work into the pageant Herod wanting to kill like all the babies two and under into the pageant. Why was, I mean, that's a part, nah, but we don't have that. And they're interesting. And you're like, good heavens, this thing is derailing. It's interesting, isn't it? We could talk about that later, but we're going to get into part of the narrative and who shows up at the birth. Who shows up and what does that mean and what where does this go and what can that help us live differently, how we can live and how we can act in such a way as to bring people together around this as well. So we're going to be in Luke chapter 2 verses 15 to 18. And it says this here, when the angels had left them, that is the shepherds, just so we get this, when the angels had left them and gone into heaven, the shepherds said to one another, let's go to Bethlehem and see this thing that has happened, which the Lord has told us about. So they hurried off and found Mary and Joseph and the baby who was lying in the manger. When they had seen him, they spread the word concerning what had been told them about this child, and all who heard it were amazed. There was wonder at what the shepherds said to them. Now, right here already, this idea of shepherds, what this tells us is the birth of Jesus has brought near the outsider, that is the fringe of society, which is exactly what the shepherds would represent and kind of who they are. Shepherds, to do shepherding, well, that is a lowly, filthy, and left to the simple kind of job. That's who is, like, these shepherds are kind of, fringe of society. They're always out in the field. Keep them there. Don't bring them near because they're dirty. And when in a society that was always about a purity code, these people are dirty and filthy, and they're kind of the fringe of society. And yet this narrative tells us that these people are not only brought near, apparently angels are speaking to them and say, we would like you all to be the ones to tell others about this story, which is all kinds of fascinating. But first, what we bring to this is that these shepherds have experienced this moment and are announcing it to others. So very interesting, because hold that. Now let's turn to our other narrative scripture in Matthew chapter 2 that gives us the story. And Matthew tells us this, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi, there it is, and oh, there's all kinds of stuff with that. Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? We could spend a month talking about that and this guy Herod right there. We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother, Mary, and they bowed down and worshiped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Now, what we do know about Magi is at the very least, they were kind of some sort of royalty or wealth or riches. We at least know that. So what happens at the birth of Jesus? You have royalty or wealth and shepherds arriving, showing up for this. So that means the upper crust and those just begging for a little bit of crust are gathered together. What a great picture of what the Christ does. Jesus connected humanity in all of its diversity by living an invitational life. Even at his birth, he was bringing all of this mishmash of humanity together. And now what Jesus is going to do, let's just look into the life of Jesus and how he invited people. And that's the question for us. How did Jesus connect people? How did Jesus connect people, and what might that mean for us? So as you stroll through the scriptures, if you were to be reading through all the scriptures, what you will find within the scriptures are the frequency of meals and banquets and feasts and stories or parables that have to do with food and gathering around food and feasts and banquets and all of these little lessons that are cast around eating and and food, it seems like this is a big deal. Now, here's where it gets really, really interesting. In the Gospels, there are three ways in which things are explained to the statement, the Son of Man came. Three ways in that this unfolds. We hear this title, the Son of Man came, and there are three explanations of what this looks like. First, in Mark, it says this, Mark 10:45, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So one, the Son of Man came to serve and to give his life. You might be thinking, yeah, I probably would have guessed he came to serve, came to give, came to whatever it may be. So you have this first one. Then in Luke 19:10, it says this, the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. Maybe again, you're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Serving, sacrificing, seeking and saving the lost. Of course, fine. But this third one is great. The third one, Luke 7:34, it says the Son of Man came eating and drinking. Isn't that fascinating? The Son of Man came eating and drinking, which of course leads to Matthew, as he says this third one. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say that is the religious elite. Here is a glutton and a drunkard and a friend of tax collectors and sinners, and I love this. But wisdom is proved right by her deeds. Huh. How interesting. Jesus came eating and drinking and hanging out with these tax collectors and sinners, and they're like, ah, we're going to label him a drunkard and a glutton, because apparently he spends lots of time eating and drinking with this low of humanity. You like that description? Right? We're just keeping it PG. Jesus was known. But here's what I love about this. Jesus is known for being a partier. Ooh, there was like silence. He was known for being a partier. How fantastic is that? He was at the party. He was a part of parties. He was throwing parties. And everyone was welcome at these parties, apparently, because he's sitting with this mishmash low class of humanity. And he's there front and center. Ooh, come on. I mean, that guy was after it. And we're like, oh man, some people are sweating. Like, no. Yeah. Yes, he was. Now, here's the thing. What's so great about these descriptions, the first two tell us what Jesus came to do, right? Serve, give his life, seek and save, that's what he came to do. What's the third one tell us? The method in which he did it. The method in which he did it. Partying. I love it. This is both radical and fairly simple, correct? It's radical and fairly simple, yet here's the thing that just gets me. How many people, religious people I talk to, that would say, man, those people just need to get saved. And if you ask them, great, how many of those people are you hanging out with? They're like, oh, I don't hang out with those people. Really? So interesting. They're going to get saved, and how are they going to get saved? Apparently not because of you, because you won't have anything to do with them. Missiologist Michael Frost, who wrote a book called Surprise the World, where we got the title for this series, he tells a story in his book of a guy he meets, befriends him. He's a pastor. This is an old Baptist pastor he meets. This pastor tells him a story. You know what? My neighbor invites me all the time. He says he's kind of famous for making these great cocktails. And he makes these cocktails, and then they have a poker night. And he invites me over to these poker nights where he has this whole crew of people that come. And Michael Frost asks him, he goes, great, how are those nights? He goes, what? I've never gone to one of those. He goes, really? What do you say? He goes, I tell him, no way, I'm not going to that. He goes, oh, interesting. He goes, so how many conversations with your neighbor have you had about like the deepest depths of life? Yeah, none really. Oh, interesting. How often have you really got to like share your faith in a really deep, meaningful way with your neighbor? He goes, I don't. Oh, maybe you ought to go to those nights and actually hang out with these people. He says, I'm not telling you have to do what they do. I'm telling you, you have said no to being with them when they, he goes, I'm not sure exactly why he invites you over. I love you and all, but why does he invite you over when you have this kind of attitude towards him? Well, I don't tell him that. And I'm like, yeah, he's a human being. He picks up on that, by the way. But then the story doesn't end there. This guy says, I'll take you up on that. He says yes to the invitation. He goes and he drinks root beer and plays cards with these guys. And he came back and told Michael Frost, we have had some of the most meaningful, deepest conversations. I've been able to share my faith up and down, in and out. We have such a fantastic time together. And he's right, these parties are quite something. Wow. Wow, interesting, right? Right. I love it. Now, here, so now let's move on to the title used because it's helpful too, Son of Man. This seems like a big deal. Son of Man comes from the book of Daniel in the Hebrew scriptures. The prophet Daniel is the one that first used this idea of Son of Man, and so we pull it from there. And it's really important because oftentimes, and from that, many view Jesus and this whole idea of even Son of Man is very esoteric, right? So things like coming on the clouds or accompanied by an army of angels, we take these things, and then what we get is we get this freaky, floaty, glowy Jesus that we see in paintings then, and either he is floating around and or there's like a glow behind him. And so we get this kind of esoteric, out-of-body, disembodied kind of ghostly Jesus, but yet the Son of Man, what you know what that means? Human. Human is what it means. Jesus comes eating and drinking, which is kind of shocking. How basic, simple, and human. Human. Son of Man, human. It's almost, now pick up on this, it's almost as if Jesus acts in ways that could be replicated and emulated by people who follow him. Are you picking up on some sarcasm in my voice? Because it's loaded. It's as Jesus says, I'm going to live in such a way that when I say come follow me, you can actually do that. And so he comes and he lives in such a way like, yeah, come follow me and we're going to connect with people and connect people to people. And this is how apparently he's going to do that. So in a time and place without police, social welfare, or insurance agencies to provide for people, mutual dependence on community was vital to survival. The early church followed Jesus' example in this way, of gathering people together in throwing parties, meals, banquets, dinners, to the disdain of empire and the leader of the day, that is Rome and Caesar. Now, here's where we're going to have some fun. Are you ready for this? Yes. Okay, good. I was going to say, I'm just going to keep talking. So in 112 AD, okay, you're about 80 years past Jesus' resurrection, if you will. In AD 112, Pliny the Younger, son of Pliny the Elder, well done there. Pliny the Younger, the Roman governor of the region we know as Turkey, wrote a letter to Emperor Trajan, the Roman Emperor Trajan, asking for advice on how to deal with these people that they gather as an ecclesia, the church. How to deal with the church, people who would gather early in the morning to sing to the Christ as a god, and then they would gather each evening and have these huge meals together. And he's writing and saying, what do I do with these people? Because they're kind of flipping things upside down. How should I handle them? What's so great is 200 years later, the Roman Emperor Julian now feared that, get this, followers of Jesus were going to overrun the government. They're all sudden scared and panicked. These people are going to overrun the government the way it's moving. How? Through loving and serving the poor, the sick, and the neglected, which it all begins with the shared meal. Now, with that. This is what Roman Emperor Julian says. We have his writings. It's so great. It says, the Galileans, and this is Julian, says, the Galileans begin with their so-called love feast or hospitality or service of tables, for they have many ways of carrying it out and hence call it by many names. And the result is that they have led very many into atheism. Oh yeah, the Roman Empire referred to followers of the way as atheists. Why? Because they chose to follow one God, the one true God, and they didn't believe in the many gods of the Greek and Roman world. So they said, oh, these atheists, they don't believe in all these gods. Isn't that interesting? So he's like, hey, we got a problem here. Then he says this, why do we not observe that it is their benevolence to strangers, their care for the graves of the dead, and the pretended holiness of their lives, a little snark in there, huh? That have done the most to increase atheism. I believe that we ought really and truly to practice every one of these virtues. This is, I mean, it's just a good time, right? So here's the thing. We'll finish it. Okay, for it is disgraceful that when the impious Galileans support not only their own poor, but ours as well, all men see that our people lack aid from us. But guess what the emperor did then? He instituted a food distribution program and they built hostels in order to welcome the stranger because he said, we need to do this. Apparently it's amazing, so we should do this. And he put this program together and guess what happened? It failed. Do you know why it failed? It failed because he couldn't get his pagan priests and Roman officials to care enough about the poor and the stranger because you can't make it a law, you can't make it obligation. It won't last. It has to be from a heart that's been met by the risen Christ. It has to be a heart of gratitude from what you have received in order to offer that to others in a giving, serving, sacrificial way. That's the only way it's going to last. Is when it's not out of obligation that you've been guilted or pushed into something, but when you go, hey, my heart, like I've been met in my mess. I'm loved, please, if I am, then I of course can love and meet others and theirs. And that just goes on and on and on and on. Are you with me? So this failed, which is just fantastic that they're trying to follow the church because the church is flipping everything on its head, including the government. Very interesting. So his plan failed, but also the early church showed that the best way here also to critique empire, that is the heavy-handed system, is to offer the better found in love and service. You want to critique something? You know what the best way to critique it isn't write a letter and say you stink, but actually do it better then. Great, do it better. Yeah, that program over there, it's not very good. Great, do it better. Do it better, because that's what they do. Great, we're going to dial up the meals. We're going to do this really, really well. And actually, then others said, we should do that. Interesting. Now, so these followers of Jesus to continue to serve up meals to the downcast, the poor, and the stranger among them. And meal by meal by meal, the entire world at that time was flipped on its head, which of course was just the pattern of Jesus, what he did. So how might a meal unfold? Because we should probably look into this. Just so you have, in the first century and even earlier, but typically what happened is people ate snacks. They would have small meal, like small snacks throughout the day, but dinner was an event. You actually had a team of people that spent the day preparing and getting ready this meal because the evening meal was going to be a communal experience. We're going to gather and we're going to feast and we're going to party. And so it was a big deal how they did this because it was a time of sharing God's goodness among us and in us and through us. So we tend to picture a meal around a table with chairs, some table settings for each person, but you would not find that there, basically that would be found more in the really, really wealthy. You might have that in the wealthy homes, but that's typically in palaces. But in the Gospels, it says that Jesus reclined at the table with his disciples. Here's the thing though. On the 20 times that it says Jesus reclined at the table with his disciples, there's actually only one of those times that it mentions the table. It's not, because what reclining looked like in that day was more a room that was just wide open, and they would have seating along the sides, but it was wide open and they would have cushions on the floor that you could lean on, lay on. There would be sheets that you could put food on, maybe a couple small tables to put drink on or a little bit of food. But the whole point was to create as much space for as many people as possible, and you lounge, lean, and actually we could unpack the Last Supper, which have them leaning, lounging. It isn't a table, so our painting, oh, no, no, they weren't around a table like that. So it wasn't that, because the typical dining room is not that way. And then cooking had to be outdoors, because you needed to have quite the fire to build the kind of, like, if you're going to cook all this food, you've got to have a huge fire. So there's not kitchens that you would have it. And so what you already have is a big massive fire where you can cook a lot of food. So here's my thing. The season we're heading into, you know the season, right? College football bowl season. You have the invention here in the first century of the tailgate party. Do you see that? It's so fantastic. You have, like, because they're cooking it up. They're all outside. It's like this big, I think so. Okay, so let's think of the Passover meal. Then you have the tradition, you have the Passover meal. It's a huge communal meal. And it said that, you know, you serve a lamb, a whole lamb, which typically, very conservatively speaking, a lamb would feed at least 15 people. And their instructions were, do not leave any meat for the next day. So not only do you have the invention of the tailgate party, you have the invention of the all-you-can-eat buffet. Are these people not the most innovative, amazing people ever? And we didn't even know it until now, and I just said it. Something like that, right? I love it, innovation. Now, even in the traditional, and I love this, Jewish homes today, did you know the dinner table is considered the family altar? They see this gathering around the table as dining with the divine. Having a meal with God, which actually goes all the way back to the book of Exodus, and dining with God. The home itself today, the home is called Mikdash Mayat. Mikdash Mayat, and it means little sanctuary where God can dwell. That's how they view, even today, the home. The home is an opportunity to invite people into God's house, to dwell with God, to hang out with God as we hang out with one another. The preparation and passion involved in setting a feast for others completely shaped, formed this community. Now, what's so great is one of my favorite scholars of context, if you will, is Lois Teverberg. She's a writer, and she's written really extensively on this, and she actually says the best picture you can get of this today is when she traveled to Uganda. And she said, in Uganda, you see this culture still lived out today. So, which I was like, yeah, because I recently was in Uganda, and that's what I got. So just to give us some pictures, an idea of what this looks like, here are some pictures. So when you're preparing a meal, again, outdoors, you got to prepare for a lot. I mean, you find the biggest thing that you can put food in that you can. And then all of these, like, these are banana branches. But they actually mash them up when we think, oh, they don't look ripe, and they mix in some flour. And the most common meal they have is matoke, is what it's called, matoke. And so it looks like kind of mashed potatoes. We had a breakfast, lunch, dinner. They serve it at every meal because it's very filling. But they have that. So next slide. Then you got cooking. I love it. As big as you can get the fire. Do you see the log? I mean, they literally, what's so funny, they cut down a tree and they just shove it underneath and they burn it and then they just keep pushing it through as it burns. Forget all the work of chopping it up. What were we thinking? Just push it through. Next, and that's matoke. They're cooking there. Do you see logs and just keep pushing them under? Cover them in banana leaves, but how much can we food? You have a team of people that are constantly cooking. Next slide. And now this is rice that they're gearing up, and it's just cooked, and all these people, and she's like that's like an oar for a boat. Do you see that? I'm sitting here watching it, and I was taking pictures, and I'm like, this is fantastic, because they're like, you got to gear up, because we're all going to eat. Next slide. Then a lady sitting there, and she's the chicken lady right there. She was like making that thing happen. These people were just this whirlwind of activity. It was stunning. But around the meal, you would have an incredible amount of laughter. There would be so much laughter around these meals, celebration. But also what's amazing is central to a meal in the first century and even till now is the talking, the conversation around the deepest depths of life. And always talking about the scriptures in the deepest depths of life. And this would be circling, and they would be talking about all this. Why? Because people at a meal moved from being strangers to friends, from friends to family. Now, in my time in Uganda, at one point when I was Friday, the 2 days before I flew home, after the different things we had done and visiting schools and the ministry, as they would say it, that we performed, that we got to share in. And so the ministry we did, we gathered at Reverend Isaac Lubega's house and with his wife Alice and their 3 kids. And so Isaac took us around to most of the places, and I spent lots of time with him. It was just so great to be there. And he said, will you come over to my family's home on Friday evening? We'll have a meal together. We had this fantastic meal in their, what we would say, living room, sitting on couches in this room, and we ate there. And you're like, oh no, we can't do that. Where's the... Of course we can. How many people? And people just showed up. And he's like, this is my sister. This is not, I'm not sure who that is. I kid you not. And I'm like, all right, but the food's on. So we have this meal. And here's the thing. At the end of the meal, this is what's so fantastic. Of about 2 weeks together with them, Isaac sits down then and we finish the meal. And he looks at me and he says, Brother Wally. And then he starts talking where I'm like, this is like a speech. He's put this together and he's worked it together. And he begins to tell me, in our culture, when a father passes away, the oldest son becomes the head of the tribe. My father has passed away and I am now the head of the Lubega tribe, which means I gave my sister over here, I gave her away at her wedding. I'm in charge of the tribe and leading it forward. And so I just want to let you know this evening, I am so grateful for the ministry you have shared with us in these 2 weeks. I am so grateful for that. I need to let you know this evening what I am doing. You will no longer be Reverend Wally Harrison, he said. You will now be Reverend Wally Lubega because you are now a part of my tribe. You want to see a grown man cry? I just started crying. I said, Isaac, what are you doing? You will always be a Lubega now. You are a part of my tribe. That's what we do at these meals. 2 days later, when I got up to give a sermon, Isaac got up and he said, I want to introduce you to Reverend Wally Lubega. To the congregation? No, this congregation. And they went, yeah! And they're laughing, but they started cheering and they're laughing because they're like, what? But it was so great because they were cheering and laughing. Like, what? But then they're like, yeah, that's what we do. And it was like, I got up and I'm like, I'm supposed to get up and talk now? And I'm crying again? Isaac, man, you're killing me. But it was so fantastic. Anybody familiar with The Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit? J.R.R. Tolkien, the author of this, says this. If more of us valued food and cheer and song above hoarded gold, it would be a merrier world. If we valued food and cheer and song above hoarded gold, it would be a merrier world. Now, here's the fascinating thing. This is so interesting. Psychologists, of course, always studying. Psychologists have said, do you know that the horror genre of movies, tell us the deepest fears of a given society at that time? So watch this. In the 1950s, the horror genre was centered around aliens. In the 1960s, it was centered around war. In the 70s and 80s, it was centered around the serial killer. In the 90s, it was centered around natural disasters. And in 2000, it centered around zombies. Now you back it up and you go, if you look at it, the 50s, why in 1947 there was a thing called what we know now as Roswell, New Mexico. In 1947, there was this flying crash and they were like, the military said, oh, no, it was just a weather balloon that crashed. And people, though, for the next number of years went, I don't know, I think it's something else. And the military's trying to cover it up. And they were like, I think it was UFOs. There's something else going on here. And so all swimming underneath in the 50s is, are there aliens? Oh, very interesting. In the 60s, you have Vietnam. So, of course, war is the thing. In the 70s and 80s, you have two people, Charles Manson and Ted Bundy, that were running kind of the media, if you will, their stories, so people feared that. In the 90s, you had Mount St. Helens erupting, and you had El Nino take place. And so natural disasters were undergirding everything. In the 2000s, why zombies? Why zombies? Here's what psychologists say. Well, easy, because you know what? Today, what people's deepest fear is that we move around in kind of groups. We bump into each other, we may share a meal together, but the fear is we're not actually really alive. You know why? Yeah. We're plugged in, but we're not connected. And so the fear is we're always in this world, but we're not actually in one another's world. And so the fear is that we're not actually connecting with people. And then they even go further and say, and then even when we get together with people, when we leave, we devour one another in speech. How many of you just had some tingling run up and down your spine because you know that it's true? Yeah. Why? Why this then? Why do we need to reclaim the shared meal? Because it's sacred and it can transform relationships. Can you see in the midst of a culture that the shared meal, getting together and eating and spending time together, can you see in this culture how profane the fast food drive-through would be? It's offensive. It's offensive. I did not see that in Uganda. There's no such thing. No such thing. Fast food drive-through. Why? What undergirds that? When the engine is productivity and efficiency, you can guarantee the steering wheel's going to be speed, convenience. How fast can we produce and get the next thing done? Well, please do not interfere with me, food. Don't get in my way, meal. So if I can just grab that thing and eat while I keep to the next thing and get the next thing done, that would be great. Yet everything was built around, centered around gathering and spending time together and having a meal. What if we chose this tradition? Let's call it that. What if we chose this tradition? Last week I said Michael Frost gives us these traditions, these habits is what he calls them, and it does an acronym, BELLS, and the first one was BLESS. What happens if we live with this idea of blessing? This one is EAT. What happens if we actually eat together? Then listen to the Christ is the next week, and then learn. Listen to the Spirit, then learn Jesus, learn the Christ is the other one, and then sent. What happens if we were left lived as sent people? That's where this is heading. But what happens if we reclaimed the art of the meal? What if we slow down and eat in order to recapture hospitality? What happens if we put our phones down and paid attention to the person sitting in front of us, standing in front of us, the person with us, the people with us? Might that transform the wider community when we see the meal as dining with the divine? What happens if that is like, we get to get together with God? So this tradition or habit completely formed and transformed the early church. Read in the Bible. What did they do first? They prayed and they ate together all the time. When? Well, every day, right? Not too surprisingly, got to do that. One of the central ways the church grew numerically and in depth in relationship was through the shared meal. And when the church withheld from the hungry, when they overconsumed or just neglected the sacredness of the meal, one of the first Christians, Paul, lit into them. Now, before we head to the Eucharist, let's look at some context around the meal. And Paul writing to the church in Corinth, and Paul says some stuff around this, but let's set it in context, because we think of ritual usually when we think of like the bread and the cup. But let's look at what Paul is saying here. In 1 Corinthians 11, verses 17, 20, and 28, it says this, Paul writing to the church in Corinth, in the following directives, I have no praise for you, for your meetings do more harm than good. So then, when you come together, it is not the Lord's Supper you eat. For when you are eating, some of you go ahead with your own private suppers. Watch what he says. As a result, one person remains hungry and another gets drunk. Don't you have homes to eat and drink in? Or, because maybe they don't, or do you despise the church of God by humiliating those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you? Certainly not in this manner. Now we're going to get into what we often hear as like ritual. For I received from the Lord what I also passed on to you. The Lord Jesus, on the night he was betrayed, took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, this is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me. In the same way, after what? He took the cup, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this whenever you drink it in remembrance of me. For whenever you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. So then, whoever eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of sinning against the body and blood of the Lord. Everyone ought to examine themselves before they eat of the bread and drink, well, of the cup. That's weird. Of the cup. Drink from the cup. So here's the thing. Oftentimes when you run into, people have been taught this is about like the bread and the cup. It's about gathering as a religious country club and then just practicing an esoteric styrofoam wafer eating and then, you know, shot of juice. And before you do that, you should examine yourselves and just see, you know, have you said any swears this week? Right? And that's what it's about. But not what Paul is saying at all. You should examine yourselves, what? Because to see if you've done something to what? Offend the body. What's the body? Who is the body is a better question, right? Not did you say swears this week? Are people sitting outside your door hungry while you gorge yourselves? That's the problem Paul has. Are you eating, but are you leaving people out? Are you creating these, well, I'm going to do my thing and I'm going to you be over there, but we're going to do this thing. Sinning against the body is about a community of people. The birth of Jesus affirmed humanity. God's love for people. So to neglect the hungry is what is offensive to the divine. Paul is asking, how can you gorge yourselves while others are going hungry? The meal is sacred in being shared, in bringing people together, all people, royalty and shepherds, right? The wealthy and the poor, which actually means when you bring all these people together, guess what happens? Labels dissolve. If people are together, you no longer have labels of wealthy and poor. You have people cared for, community you belong to, period. Are you with me? I think we're preaching. Now, the Eucharist. Before we step into that, as I remember what it is, Eucharist. I use that word. The word Eucharist is actually two words. It means good gift. Good gift. Because Jesus is God's good gift to the world. And then an abundant gift. Enough. Real quick. Do you realize and there are two feeding stories in the Gospels of Jesus feeding 5,000 plus and Jesus feeding 4,000 plus. And then we have what we call the Lord's Supper where he gathers with his disciples before he is crucified, right? Now, here's the thing. Older Testament Hebrew scholar Walter Brueggemann says these stories, all three of them, are tied together with four verbs, all of them. He took, he blessed, he broke, he gave. Tie all these stories together. To remember the body broken and the blood poured out is to receive in abundance, then taking, blessing, breaking, and giving in abundance is the call. At those stories where Jesus fed all these people, who passed out the food? The disciples. Hey, I'm going to do this. You're going to now take this and you're going to walk this out. I'm going to show you how to do this and I'm going to tell you what to do and then you go and live this. There is an abundance. When he brought them to the Lord's Supper, the same verbs were used. He took, he received, he blessed, he broke, he gave. Now will you please do the same? Are you with me? So when we come to this ritual, if you will, this tradition, this practice, this habit, it's just to actually stir us to remember every time we eat, anytime we have sustenance, we have some drink, we should remember that God has generously poured out for us and we should generously pour out for others. Who are we inviting to the table? Generally speaking, there are 7 days in a week, generally speaking. Let's just go ahead and say, let's just go ahead that most of us maybe in this room have 3 meals a day. How many meals is that? 21. Might we even today reclaim, recapture the art of hospitality in the meal? What happens if we just took one out of 21 and said, this will be for others to come to? Participate in. We're going to invite the neighbor who is now going to go from being a neighbor to a friend. We're going to invite the acquaintance who will move from being an acquaintance to a friend. We're going to invite the friend who's going to move from friend to family, because that's what this is. And we'll just start with one. I'm low barring this thing for us. 21, can you do one? One. And maybe you're thinking no, because most of them are really fast. Oh, so maybe we need to back the trolley up and practice the art of sitting down with other people ourselves first. And then we can invite others to the party. So then, the Eucharist. I would love to have a couple people on this side, and they're going to offer us the bread and the cup, and there will be a couple of us over on this side, and we're just going to invite you to reflect on this and what it means to eat and drink and to celebrate that God gave, broke, and poured out for us to receive, to say yes to accept, yeah. But then that will stir us, drive us, motivate us, provoke us to do the same for others. And so when we come to this, we think of this bread, well, this is a gift. When we think of the cup, yeah, this was poured out as a gift, as putting us back together, of healing us, of saving us. And then we, in turn, will break ourselves open and pour ourselves out so others can experience this truth as well. So I'd love to pray, and then we'll just invite you. There will be 2 people over here with bread, 2 people over here with bread and cup, and so you can come as you feel led, and you might just hear these words. This just is a picture of Jesus' body given for you. This is a picture of Jesus' blood poured out for you. You'll take and rip off a piece of bread, dip it in the cup, and then you may have a seat and just reflect and think together before we wrap up with a benediction. Gracious God, we bless you for right here, for right now, for the invitation to your table, God. All shepherds and royalty alike are invited to your party. God, may we say yes. May we here today know that you have created us. You love us immensely, and we are invited to the table. May we say yes. May we receive that invitation, accept that invitation. And then may God in that stir our hearts to open our lives to others, to the other, that they would experience belonging, love, your truth in the invitation. the table. So God, we're grateful for the way in which you have broken yourself open and poured yourself out for all. And God, we bless you for this time and this opportunity. We do this in remembrance of your love and the truth of your love offered to us. In the name of Christ, amen.